Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers, first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Elizabeth Strout. Strout was born in Portland, Maine in 1956, and from a young age was drawn to writing. As a youth, she developed a deep love for the natural world while playing outside by herself and with her brother. By her teenage years, Strout was memorizing poems and sending out her own short stories to magazines. While she published short fiction through her 20s and 30s, it was not until she was 44 that her first novel, Amy and Isabel, was published. It was shortlisted for the Orange Prize and nominated for the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. In 2009, Strout won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for her collection of connected short stories, Olive Kitteridge. Her most recent novel is The Burgess Boys. All of her books have been national bestsellers. Join me now for Elizabeth Strout, speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Chitzer Concert Hall as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2011.
Hello. I'm so happy to be here. And I want to thank Portland Literary Arts for inviting me, but also for being so accommodating. I mean, this is so darling. I have a whole new sense of what can be done. And thank you all for coming out tonight. I have some thoughts that I've sort of written down, and we'll try not to make it all sound dull. When I have been to Portland a number of times since my first book was published, and every single time I've just loved it. I've just had a fabulous time. Last year I was unable to get back to New York because of weather in New York, and I had a fantastic time being snowed in the opposite direction here in Portland. Such a cozy feeling. So I'm just really always glad to be here. And then today, as Andrew was walking me into the hotel, he pointed to the marquee out in front of this theater, and there was my name. I don't believe I've ever seen that before. And it was daunting, but there was this tiny part of me that thought, you know, I should take a picture of that. But there was a much larger New England part of me that thought, don't you dare. And that made me think about John Cheever, who was born in Quincy, Massachusetts, and how his mother wrote to him at one point and said, Johnny, why haven't you let me know that you were a successful writer? And he wrote back and said, I thought you'd be mad at me for bragging. Which I understand. Also on the drive-in from the airport, we were talking about cities and Portland. I was born in Portland, Maine, and here's Portland, Oregon. And we were talking about the different cities that we've been to. And except for a year that I spent in England after I graduated from college, I had never lived outside of New England in any American city until I moved to Syracuse, New York. And so that was kind of my first love of a city. And I suspect it's not many people's first love of a city. But I think, you know, cities are like people. Some you just like and some you don't like. And some it makes a lot of difference at the point in life you are when you meet them. And I went to Syracuse in 1979 to go to law school. And I didn't go to many law school classes and spent a lot of time wandering around the city. It had a downtown area, and today when I was looking out of the hotel window at the Heathman, I thought, oh, this is what Syracuse was supposed to look like. I walked around a lot. I didn't, of course, have a car or any money, and I spent a lot of time going into that's back when they had department stores in Syracuse downtown, and I would go in and spray myself with perfume. And then when I dropped out of law school the first time, and my father said, well, what do you expect to do for a job? And I said, I expect to work in a department store in Syracuse. And that's what I did. thinking that it was somehow going to be glamorous, and it wasn't glamorous. You're supposed to sell, apparently, if you work in a department store. And I remember my manager explaining that to me one day, that when somebody came in and tried on a skirt, I was to follow them into the dressing room with a blouse and suggest that it would look good with a skirt. And first of all, I would, of course, have no idea what blouse would look good with a skirt. But I understood that I couldn't do it. And I think without having the language at the time, I look back and I think, you know, it would have been a real false sense, let's put it that way. If I didn't believe that skirt looked good with the blouse, it would have been a very false sentence, and it was not something I was up to, and so I was demoted to mattresses. And when I checked in today at the Heathman, the lovely woman behind the counter said, "Do you have a preference for mattresses?" I thought that was astonishing. And it reminded me that I had once sold them. But I didn't sell them because I didn't know anything about mattresses. And still don't. But nobody ever came up to the mattress floor up in Syracuse at that time. And when they did, I just said, "I don't know anything about it, but you can lie down." And they didn't. And I did go back to law school, but I really just wanted to mention the concept of cities and sort of loving where you are. And now I've been in New York City for I don't do math that well, but I think it's more than half my life, or about half my life. When the numbers stop being zero, I can't quite get it. But recently I moved from one apartment to another in Syracuse, in New York, and this is what I really want to talk to you about and what I'm here for. As I made that move, I went through a lot of old papers the way we do when we move, and I came across something I'd written down that happened just a couple years ago, and I had forgotten about it, except there it was, I jotted it down. And it was an incident where I was at a wedding, and I was seated at a table with a man, I didn't know him very well at all, but he was at the table. I did know that he was very well known in his medical field. And I also knew that his daughter was a novelist. And at one point, halfway through the evening, this man said to the entire table with real disgust, he leaned forward and said, "My daughter devotes her life to telling lies." And I kept my mouth shut that night, but as I was playing this scene over and thinking of what I wanted to say about why I think fiction matters, I believe the man really believed what he was saying. I think he really believed that his daughter devoted her life to telling lies. But now I'm here, and I'm not going to keep my mouth shut about it. I'm here to tell you why I think that's not true, and the opposite is true, that in good fiction you're not finding lies, you're finding the truest things. And I'll try and talk to you for a little bit about why I think it matters that we find those things, and even sort of address what that phrase "truest thing" might mean. So first I want to address the situation of limitation of view. I want to point out the most obvious but to me desperately important fact, which is that we will never know what it's like to be another person. Not really. And the knowledge of this, the awareness of this, has come to me in increments throughout my life. But there was one particular moment when it really hit me, probably for the first time. I did grow up in the woods in New Hampshire and Maine. And for many years in New Hampshire, there wasn't another house in sight. But then one year, a couple bought the land nearby and built this little house. It was very pretty. And sweet, and they were awfully nice, and the next year they had a baby, and there were window boxes, and it just was all darling. And one night when my parents were out of town, I babysat for the baby, and because my parents were gone, I ended up spending the night there. And in the morning, the woman of this house made French toast. She cut it in triangles, and she sprinkled confectionery sugar all over it. And in my entire life, short as it was, I had never seen anything so magnificent. So when my parents returned, I made sure to tell my mother about this in careful detail. And I'm sure I was hoping, of course, that she might take the hint and think about preparing breakfast for us in such an exquisite manner. But when I got done going on about my observations of what I considered to be this, such true loveliness and this marvelous couple and how kind the woman was and how decent her husband seemed and how pretty the baby was, my mother looked at me for a long time, and then she just said, "Just remember, Elizabeth, you never know." So that had quite an impact on me. And as the years have gone by, I've had to agree. I didn't know, and I don't know. And I don't have any idea, really, what went on in their house. I certainly have no idea what went on in either one of their minds. And as I've gotten older, I've even had more respect for the fact that they probably didn't know what was going on in each other's minds either. But my point is this: we think we know our neighbors. We really think we know our loved ones and our children, our best friends who share confidences with us. But I think my mother was right. We never really do know. It's always made me very sad and very frustrated. So basically, I've spent my life being plagued ceaselessly with the question, what does it feel like to be another person? And I think fiction is one of the places that we come closest to knowing what it might feel like to be another person, or at least we get some glimpses. And I'm sure most people here in this auditorium can remember the first time when they were reading a book that they thought, "Oh, I've had that thought, that's like me." And it might not have even been a very momentous thought, but somewhere on the page as you went through the book, there was some fleeting recognition of the self. So why does it matter if we recognize ourselves in a book? And why does it matter that we contemplate what it feels like to be somebody else? In Ulysses, James Joyce refers to the painful character of the ultimate functions of separate existence. That's James Joyce, so I'm going to repeat it. The painful character of the ultimate functions of separate existence. And if we are, as I like to think, basically more alike than we are different, we still need to acknowledge that those differences have their own singularity and character, and actually, I think, can be quite painful. So fiction is there to let us know we're not alone, that whatever we've thought and felt has probably been thought and felt before. I know a woman who does not read any fiction or any poetry. She's not the least bit interested. She's made that very clear. She says it's not her thing. Okay. And I see her about once a year, and the last time I saw her, she's what I would call middle-aged, whatever that means, you know, young middle-aged. She said to me, "Oh, life is so strange." I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, it's not at all like what I thought it would be." And I said, "Okay." And she said, "You know how when you're young and you think you'll do it different, you think you'll do it better than your parents did?" And I said, "Well, you know, we all think that. Most of us think we'll do it better than our parents did." And she said, "Well, you know, I wanted kids, and I have them, and I love them, of course, but, you know, they kind of drive me nuts, and being married, that's, you know, well, that's a lot, she said, and she laughed, and she said, I don't know, I just didn't know it would be like this. And then she said, I mean, it's all kind of so ickily human. And I thought to myself, sweetheart, you should have read more. I mean it. Because where else do we learn about life? Where else do we learn about what she called ickily human? The fact that, yeah, people are so human. They're petulant and needy, and they snore, and they get sick. Or they squander days of health. And they worry us, and they confuse us, and they drink too much. Or they don't drink at all, which makes you feel dreadful if you need a glass of wine. And they can break our hearts with just one glance of their vulnerability. And they can be unbelievably kind. So where do we learn all this stuff? Not on some TV reality show. In fact, I think much of television is popular for the very reason that it doesn't require us to think in complicated ways. Things are presented cartoonishly large. Here's a pretty girl who was done wrong. Here's a sensitive fellow who got left in the dust. Here's a good cop with a bad decision to make. Here's a bad mother who messes up her kids. We're not called upon to ponder the intricacies that are always present in real life. And so we think of humanness as being icky. And I think that's a real shame. I think it means that we're turning our backs on the responsibility that we have. I think of it as the responsibility to bear the burden of the mystery of what it is we're up to in life. F. Scott Fitzgerald said the sign of a genius is a man who can keep two opposing thoughts in his head at one time. And his work certainly shows his ability to keep many, many thoughts in his head at one time. But I don't think you have to be a genius to do this. I think you just have to be open. And I think fiction helps keep us open. I think fiction prevents us from becoming dogmatic. When I read John Updike's final book, Rabbit at Rest, the final book of the Rabbit series, I was struck with the fact that this man, Rabbit, you know, he does some pretty despicable things. He's very disregarding of his wife. He's not generous toward his longtime mistress. His son drives him just bananas. And his daughter-in-law's distress, he answers by sleeping with her. This is when my own father-in-law put the book down and said, "It's just too disgusting. I can't read that." And that's... But that's the, you know, that's the right of any reader. We make choices like that in life, and we certainly have the choice to make, to decide what we want to read and what we're comfortable reading. But for those like me, who apparently have a higher threshold of disgustingness, I was struck with the fact that as I read that book, I was cheering for this man, this aging rabbit. And every time he shoved more orange Doritos or cheese puffs into his mouth, I thought, oh, don't do that. Your heart's not good. And by the end of the book, which if you haven't read, I won't spoil it, but the title kind of does, I really felt like I'd lost a good friend. And I thought, why? I think it's because Updike managed to paint that man as so human that the so-called ickily human part of him disappeared for me. And this is what I think fiction can do. It can give us a break from being judgmental. Fiction can, I think, make us bigger. So the experiences gathered in life and our accumulated losses, all of that should by itself make us bigger. You'd like to think that. But it doesn't necessarily. We know that by just looking around at people as they age. Some get bigger, and some get bitter. And the problem, I think, that we're struggling against is that we are locked forever behind our own two small eyes. But when you open the right book, there it is. Look how everyone else has stumbled along. I'm not alone in this. And even better, when I pass that man in the grocery store who seems gruff and unpleasant and icky, I don't have to see him that way only. I have Rabbit Angstrom now as a friend, and so I know that everyone is 1,000 times more complicated than what they appear to be. So fiction should, I think, help us with our limitation of vision. So now let's think about limitation of language. The fabulous poet Louise Glick says, "We look at life once in childhood, the rest is memory." Another poet, Edna St. Vincent Millay, said, "Childhood is the kingdom where nobody dies." What both these lines say to me is that impressions of childhood are fundamentally truthful and as of yet uncorrupted. But if we look at life once in childhood and the rest is memory, where is that memory going to come from? From the language that we're taught to use to capture it. And if childhood is the kingdom where nobody dies, what do we do with the bombardment of realities and losses that are to follow? The memories and understandings of our adult life are shaped by language. And this language is so frequently distorted, I think we need to at least consider it if we're discussing the importance of fiction. A few times I've heard exasperated mothers say to, you know, their young children, "Oh, I could just kill you." Or, "I'm going to knock your heads together." And, you know, first of all, children are very literal. So it's distressing right there, but if one argues, and people do, don't worry about it, that child knows that she's not really going to kill them, it's just a way of talking. Well, I still say, then what is the child supposed to make of language? How is the child supposed to learn to give voice himself to the complexities of life? Or to think of it another way, in the building that I just left, that I moved out of in New York, I knew everybody on the floor. I loved it. We were such a great floor. Anyway, there was a young mother, and she recently, well, before I left, she had thrown a party, a birthday party for her 3-year-old son. Now, given that I've just said that we don't really know anyone, she certainly appears to me to be a lovely woman. I think she is. But this party was big, and it lasted all afternoon, and people were coming and going, and lots of commotion and stuff. And so naturally, the child became overly excited. And at the end of the day, I heard the child crying, saying, "I hated my birthday. I just hated my birthday." And the mother said soothingly, "You didn't hate your birthday. You had a lovely birthday." Now, it's not my job here or anywhere, really, to discuss how to best socialize our children. That's someone else's bailiwick. But that's not what I'm here for. But the point that I want to make is the use of the language that we grow up with. And this same child has 2 brothers, and, you know, they frequently fight. Not that much, but, you know, they're 3 little boys, and they do fight every so often. And one of them I can hear say, "You know, I hate my brother. Fiercely, I hate my brother." And the really nice mother patiently says, "You don't hate your brother. You love your brother." But I think at the moment that child is speaking, with the fury of impotence and narcissistic rage that children feel, I think he really does at that moment hate his brother, and I think he really did hate his birthday. And when we're told, as we are, by our well-meaning mothers and fathers and teachers, that what we feel is simply not true, then how, as we develop, do we recognize our own feelings? How do we know what we're feeling? And why does it matter? I think it matters because to live unconsciously is to live only half a life. And to live unconsciously cheats those who live with us from having the full and honest and complicated experience of a real life partner or parent or family member. And because if we don't know what we're feeling, we don't know what we're doing. And as Isabel Goodrow realizes in Amy and Isabel, what we do matters.
You're listening to a talk by Elizabeth Strout. She spoke as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2011. More from Strout is coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Elizabeth Strout.
When we pick up a book, I think we become like children, and we hope for and expect someone to be in charge, because we need to feel a sense of safety. Because as we read that book, we may look at things that are not safe feeling, we may have emotions that don't feel safe as we read along, but we are always safe in the hands of the writer. I think this is what we need to feel. So what do I do to try and make the reader feel safe? Well, first and foremost, I try not to lie to them. I try not to write a sentence or a scene that's simply a shortcut to a cheap emotion. I want the reader to earn their way with me. And when I talk about keeping the reader safe, I mean that I'll try not to show off. I don't want there to be a subtext that whispers, see how clever I am and what big words I can use. Because sometimes I do that, and I have to go back and say, I'm showing off. I want to use words that seem right and necessary for what I'm rendering. What I try and do when I work is find that sentence that can resonate with the dignity that the human experience deserves. A sentence of muscularity that can hold both the gravity and the felicity of returning us to those more primitive emotions. For me, it means finding the right sound that conveys the combination of truth and compassion. That's a combination I'm very, very interested in, truth and compassion. So here's an example of when my training for this first began, consciously anyway. When I was a small child, for a while my family attended a congregational church. Now, if you're not familiar with this denomination, particularly this New England version of that denomination, I just need to tell you it's a no-frills business. Plain is the name of the game. No hats, nothing like that. But on one particular Sunday, there was this friend of my parents named Clara, and she did wear a hat. And it wasn't Easter or anything. She just showed up wearing a hat. And it was some hat. I'd never seen anything like it. It had, you know, fake fruit and ribbons coming down it. And it was very puzzling to me and almost scary, really. And riding home in the back seat, afterwards, I listened to my mother say to my father, "Now, why in hell would Clara wear that hat?" And I was so relieved, naturally, because there she was, voicing my own bafflement. And my father said, "There was nothing wrong with that hat. And if you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything at all." This was a very common refrain of my father's. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. Well, it's a fabulous idea, but it's death for a writer. And I think that day started the conscious awareness of the struggle that I was going to live with as a person and, of course, as a writer. The juxtaposition between bald truths and decency. Because the trouble was, I knew perfectly well that day that my father was the more decent person. But my mother was a lot more interesting. Especially when she said those things that were true. So my job as a writer has been to find the language that can hold both, convey both, the lack of judgment and the truth of the observation. Now, in real life, we make judgments all the time, and frankly, we should. We decide who's mean, who's stingy, who's generous, who's kind, who can be counted on. This is how we maneuver our way through the mess of human interactions. And yet, it is tiresome. It's tiresome to be thinking that such and such is right and so is wrong. It's tiresome when a friend who supported us through many tribulations now actually seems irritated by our sudden good fortune. What's that about? Sam, we think. You're supposed to be able to count on you, Sam. And it's tiresome, even when we know that nobody is all good and all bad. So any piece of fiction worth its salt is going to remind us of this. Any piece of fiction worth its salt will remind us that the bafflement we experience in living is a correct response to the messiness of how complicated we all are. I had a professor in college who used to say, "Compose yourself in a composition." Of course, we all made fun of him, poor thing. You know, rolling our eyes, "Compose yourself in a composition." But I thought of it so many times, and the fact is that something in me does compose myself when I write. And also there's something in me that feels composed when I read. The messiness of experience becomes coherent. The right sentences, I think, can calm us down, even if they lift us into states of joy or contemplation. And I think any good piece of fiction should make us feel included and not excluded. We should feel invited in. When I read A Fine Balance by Coetan Mistry, I entered a world of poverty in India, and it was poverty like I've never seen myself, and thank God never experienced. I mean, I've never slept on a sidewalk or any of those things that are in that book. And yet, even while reading about those extreme discomforts, I was composed. I felt better. And every time I put that book down, I couldn't wait to get back to it. And I thought about that. Why? And I think it's because the inner lives of those characters were presented with generosity and compassion, and there were enough feelings that I did recognize so that I was with them. And it was that amazing experience of something hugely new in terms of the landscape and the culture, and yet comfortingly familiar in terms of the human emotions. It was a big, big, big tapestry, that book, of society and corruption and evil and despair and hope. And it was a large canvas he was painting on, and it was a subject that was natural to him. And it is part of a fiction writer's job to figure out what their subject is. His subject was India. My subject has been New England. And I'm a big believer in the, I think now, somewhat old-fashioned idea that literature is place. I think that we all have some relationship to place. Even a friend of mine who was raised moving every year or two because her father was in the army, even her sense of placelessness is almost her story. So place is a very American kind of aspect to the literature that we read and write. And I'd been writing for years and years before I figured out that place thing. I'd been living in New York for many years before I even realized that I came from New England. And that coming from New England meant that I was different from someone who came from Louisiana or someone who grew up in the Upper East Side of New York. It's odd to me, really, when I think about it, that it took me so long to figure this out. I imagine it was because my childhood was such an isolated one that it took me a long time to understand my relationship to the rest of the world, let alone what that relationship might be. And, as Andrew mentioned, I did figure this out in a stand-up comedy class in New York. I'd been writing stories for many years, and I'd had some success, some placements in magazines and journals. And then there came a time when I was no longer able to complete a story. And that was very, very frightening. So I thought, well, what am I hiding? Because I knew enough at that point to understand that when the writing went so poorly in such a dramatic way, something false was happening. But I really didn't know what. I kept thinking of Hemingway saying, well, get up and write the most honest sentence you know. And I think, but I'm trying. I didn't know what that meant. So I decided to take a stand-up comedy class. I'll tell you why. It wasn't just, you know, that or shock treatments. It was because I have always been interested in comedy, and it seemed to me that people laugh at something that's true and something that most people don't dare say, and somebody else is saying it, and so that's why they laugh if they're listening to a comedian. So I got very interested in this, and I thought to myself, because, you know, writing is such a squirrely, fiction writing is such a, you know, you're so alone, you're all squirrely and weird, and you can do whatever you want, and nobody's looking. And I thought, what would happen if I had to stand right in front of the audience and be responsible for making them laugh? What is it that would pop out of my mouth? It seemed to me a kind of pressure cooker to put myself in, and what would it be that would come out of my mouth? Well, I honestly do think that it probably took a couple years off my life. It was so terrifying. And I wasn't the only one. I took this class at the New School in New York, and every single week people would drop out. It was, you know, you see them out front chewing their cigarettes and then just saying, I can't go in. It was just very frightening. But those of us who made it through had to perform at a stand-up comedy club, a real one, in New York as sort of the final exam. And I did. I didn't let anybody come. I didn't let anybody know. It's on tape somewhere, but I did. Anyway, the point of it is, what came out of my mouth that night? Well, I talked about hair. And this was before I wrote Amy and Isabel, where hair plays an important role. I didn't know, really, until I did that routine that I had these hair issues. I talked about my in-laws, who were genuine, are genuine New Yorkers. But mostly I made fun of myself and my Puritan roots. And that's when I began to understand that I had a very particular thing that was essential to who I was, as much as I might not want to think so, which is that I am truly from Puritan stock. 8 generations on one side, 10 generations on the other side, I am really, really white and kind of uptight. That was pretty much the substance of my piece. So I had a subject, uptight white person, and place, New England. And I began to become a novelist. But that brings me to the question of voice, because what voice would I find to carry the narrative of my work? And this is where the ear is essential for a writer. A writer must listen very hard to hear the true voice from the false voice. Now, I've already mentioned that our first neighbors, talked to you about our first neighbors in New Hampshire, but in Maine, we lived on the end of a dirt road, and very few people lived on that road who were not my relatives. These were mostly great aunts. And because we had no television and there were no children my age except for my brother, who long ago dismissed me by the age of 3, I think he was done with me. So my idea of recreation was to wander in and out of the houses of these elderly relatives, and I absorbed their voices. They were a very crabby and disgruntled group of New England people. My Aunt Polly had taught third grade her entire life, and she hated children. She would stick her tongue out at me when I sat in her living room. And I mention this because it's amazing to me what children absorb as normal. It wasn't until I went to college and began to go visit the homes of my college friends, and they would have aunts around, you know, Catholics or Irish or Italian or Jewish, And they were pleasant, but not so much in my family. These women, my relatives, they had a favorite pastime of discussing their husband's last meal. Frank's last meal had been mackerel, and Lucille, smoking a cigarette and looking absolutely dismal, would recall this again and again and say she was so glad she'd happened just by coincidence to slice the potatoes that night rather than bake them, because Frank had always preferred a sliced potato. She was quite certain of that. Then they would discuss which one of them would die first. They assumed it would be my Aunt Dot because she'd been 3 pounds when she was born and she was highly nervous. But of course, poor Aunt Dot lived forever. Actually, they all did. But this was the music. This was the sound of my youth. The language was dry and clipped and rhythmic. And there was one other time that I remember recognizing, you know, as I've gone over and thought about this, recognizing the concept of voice. And that was when I went to live in England after college for 1 year, before I returned to go to Syracuse and go to law school. The reason I went to England when I finished college was because I didn't want to figure out that job business. I wanted to be a writer. And I think in the South, they're nicer about that, and maybe out here they are as well, but certainly in New England, if you graduate from college and say you want to be a writer, people look at you with embarrassment, as though you've just leaked some grandiosity that you shouldn't have. So I went to England, and I worked in pubs, and I cleaned houses for old people and wrote stories. And my father said to me, of course, he said, you know, after such an expensive education, I have to tell people that you're a barmaid. But when I wrote home and said that I was scared of getting arrested, because I have to tell you, I was working illegally in those pubs, and I was scared of getting arrested, my mother said, oh, go ahead and get arrested. They'll feed you in jail. So I stayed there a year, and then I just got worn out. I just got worn out and decided I had to come home. So the day that I took the bus from London out to Heathrow, I got on that bus, and it was filled with Americans. And they were so loud, and their voices were all flat and twangy, and I just loved them. And I remember thinking, I love the American voice. And I do, and there are many, many versions of it, as we know, but it's been sort of an honor for me as a writer to feel a part of the continuum of our own particular language. So I was developing the idea of voice, and my mother herself has always had a fabulous voice and storytelling ability. She inherited it from her grandmother, who would talk in the kitchen about the girls at the farmhands. Hired hands had gotten into trouble. And I'm sure if my father had been there, he would not have approved of any of it. But any storyteller knows that it's not the substance of the story that matters. It's how the story is told. And my mother had a real knack for that. There's a line in one of my stories. I honestly don't remember where it is, but I know that there's a line in some story I wrote where a mother says, complaining of psychiatrists, they go straight for the mother each time. And, you know, it's true. And I go straight for my mother each time in discussing how I really became a writer. Because it's not just my mother's storytelling voice that I absorbed, or her uncanny lines like, you never know, but also her deep interest in people. And there was nothing in my youth that was as much fun as people watching with my mother on those occasions when we went into town and got off that dirt road. Well, there's a woman who's not anxious to get home, she'd say, as we watched someone amble down the sidewalk. I'd say, how do you know she doesn't want to get home? How do you know? Well, take a look at her, Elizabeth. Does that woman look to you like she's anxious to get home? So I'd look, and I'd look, and I'd see a woman who increasingly seemed to take on physical aspects beyond her years. And I would begin to imagine not just her state of mind, but the home that she didn't want to go to. The dark hallways she might enter, the kitchen with its green tiles. I just could not stop my mind from imagining what it was like to be that woman. And this is part of the legacy from my mother, the continual desire to always be imagining what it's like to be another person. There's some intuitive sparking of the imagination, and it is an intuition. For many years, I was married to a lawyer, and that's a different kind of experience because it's expected that certain things require proof. Not very long ago, I was sitting in a hotel room with my mother up in Maine, where she lives, and she glanced out the window, which looked out over a parking lot, and she said, "Huh. Second wife." And I said, because of the lawyerly training that I had had, I'd returned to law school, and because she irritates me sometimes, I said, "Mom, why are you always saying that? Why are you always doing that?" And I went over to the window, and I looked out, and I said, "Oh, second wife." Now, we happened to be alone, so no proof was required. And for a fiction writer, the proof is always in the gut. We intuit what's true and what's not, and it is really a visceral thing. We pay for our work with our bodies. There goes a lung, a piece of liver, stomach damaged forever. Because writing is physical work, it's the reason that I write by hand. I want the physicality of earning my way through that sentence. And then I rewrite the sentence many, many times. Writing is an artifice, and you know, don't forget that, we know that. But it's the writer's job to make the reader feel that it's as natural as breathing. Just like when we watch an ice skater, we don't want to be aware of any effort. We just want to be inside the experience. I want people to feel, right along with Olive, what it's like to sit in the living room of Louise Larkin. What it's like to drive to the nursing home to see your husband, what it's like to have a date with a man when you're in your 70s. I want the reader to believe it. Not long ago, this past year, I attended a talk on white-collar crime. I don't know why. I saw it advertised and I wanted to go. So I did. And the lawyer who gave this talk, really lovely, well-dressed woman, gave this talk. And about halfway through the talk, she leaned over the podium and she took on a real intensity and she said, with great knowingness, just remember, people, everybody lies. People lie all the time, she said. And what surprised me most, really, was how the audience immediately started nodding their heads. And it was just one of those moments I thought, oh, right, right. We do, I guess. And then I started thinking, of course, you know, how many people I tell, you know, I like their haircut when I don't. And, you know, I like their new glasses when I don't. And, you know, you shouldn't worry about your son so much, even though I personally think he's headed for trouble. And, you know, I mean, I do that all the time. And maybe this is just, you know, harmless white lies or whatever. But I think that when you really, really add up all the stuff that escapes our mouths that's simply false, then you realize how parched we are for that emotion, that sentence that's true. And you can find this, hopefully, in fiction. Because out there in the real world, there's clearly a sense of treachery that accompanies us. And the book that invites you inside should be safe. No matter what goes on in that book, you should feel safe. Because life can be a pretty lonely business a lot of the time. but a whole lot less so, I think, when we stop feeling defensive or guilty and find out that our own story is as old as the hills, really. So we go to fiction to find comfort, escape, and I think sometimes as well, a feeling of transcendence. Jan Martel, who wrote Life of Pi, says that it's through literature that one can see life through the other, and that this makes us better people. He thinks literature can make politicians better leaders, and at one point was reportedly sending the Canadian Prime Minister a new book of fiction every 2 weeks with a handwritten note on why the book was worth reading. To my knowledge, the last I checked, I did check this, the Prime Minister had yet to write back. And until I hear that he has, I'm holding off on sending any books to Washington. But I do share Martel's belief that fiction can and should help widen our vision and exercise our muscle of compassion and therefore improve our lives considerably and the lives of those we touch. And so I say now to that man who accused his novelist daughter of devoting her life to telling lies, no, she does not. She devotes her life to trying to save lives as much as you do as a doctor. And to that boy down the hall from where I used to live who screamed that he hated his birthday, I have no idea how he, you know, as he grows up, how he'll remember his birthday. I suspect he will remember the goodwill of his mother. But I hope that someday he can pick up a book and recognize that sense of impotent rage that he felt once and still feels at times, because who doesn't? And feel better about it, feel okay about it, seeing that it's not a crime to be human. That in fact, reading is a celebration of the mystery of ourselves. And reading can connect ourselves to another in a way that's really unique and ultimately, I think, necessary. Because what do we have in this life if not each other? Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Strout speaking at the Arlene Schitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 2011. Strout is a writer of fiction and won a Pulitzer Prize for her novel Olive Kitteridge. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any of the other talks in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.